This is Phil Farron, and I'm driving home. I was looking up on my little smartphone there to see what episode this is. It is episode 94. I did record an episode 93, but it has been such a wild week. I did not upload it last week. Sorry. Not that anybody's listening, so, you know, it's fine. I can't even remember what I talked about last week. But, wow, I was just in Walmart picking up some supplies. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Picking up some supplies, and who should I run into but my wonderful son-in-law. And so we walked around, and I helped him look for his things, and we chatted a little bit. And I told him, I said, man, it seems like it's been forever since I've seen you and talked to you. And it's just like Sunday, but whoo, things have been exciting. Wow. Okay, so Vaneworks Stand is turning into a very interesting project. I'm starting to amass data now on when people buy and when they don't buy. And mostly they're not buying yet, but that's okay. I'm amassing some information. And I'm getting more data in, which is important. So that is going to be fun. It's going to be a challenge. It's going to be really, really interesting. And I've, you know, trying to move some of the big rocks out of the way when I identify, okay, here we have a contact point, or here we're losing when we should be gaining, you know, all those types of things. And trying to figure out, okay, why are we not getting responses here? What's going on? That kind of thing. I've sent some out and gotten very, very nice responses back, you know, doing customer support things and answering emails. And so, it's very interesting. But I have talked about that enough. I'm really just going to kind of be down in the trenches now with it for some time to come. And honestly, that's the way a lot of things are in life. You're in the trenches for a long time with things. It's like writing a book. You know, you suddenly come out and say, I have written a book! And people don't have any concept of how many hours and hours and hours that you have spent at your computer, or writing it out longhand, depending on what your method is. They have no idea how long you have spent doing that, working over each paragraph, over and over. Excuse me. And this is going to be a lot like that. I don't know that there's any point in me every week going, well, today I altered the website this way. I mean, that's going to get, who wants to listen to that? So I'm just going to keep working my little deal there and keep amassing information and keep trying to hone and trying to make some progress, uphill progress. And then maybe if there's something to say in 3 or 4 months, then I'll say something. Instead of that, I'm going to get back to the topics. I used to do a topic every week, and there's lots of things to talk about. And so I've got a topic today that I find very interesting that we'll get to in a minute. As far as the excitement this week my wife had surgery on her thyroid. They removed her thyroid. It had some growths on it, some goiters, and there was some concern, frankly, about how she would come out of the surgery, because the thyroid and the goiters and everything, they pretty much sit on top of the nerve endings that control the voice. And so there was a potential that when the surgeon opened up that area, that the only way he was going to be able to complete his task would be by damaging the vocal cords, which would mean that my wife wouldn't be singing anymore for the rest of her life. And since she's a worship pastor, that was a fairly significant eventuality to ponder. Thankfully, everything went well. And even in the run-up up to it, although we did sit and talk about eventualities and did sit, and since I was going to be the front person making the decision when the doctor came out and said, here's our options, I just ran all the scenarios with her and said, sweetie, I need to know what you want to do in these situations. And so we talked through all of that. She gave me very clear instructions. And so I felt like I was prepared, and the doctor came out and said everything went great. Good, 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 good. My wife was talking shortly after she got out of recovery, although she was hoarse. Excuse me. She was hoarse because they had a breathing tube down her, and it scratched up her vocal cords. And she said today the inside of her mouth is really sore, but it's the second day after surgery, so that's always... you know, that's always the rough day. So that's been very exciting, kind of scheduling and figuring out what needs to be done when and picking her up and taking her back. Thankfully, her parents are here in town, and so they've been helping out. And so everything's gone just fine. In addition to that, we had a cold snap here, which was very uncharacteristic for this area. It only got to 15 yesterday. And last night, it was actually, had gotten down to 1 degree, which is very unusual for us. It had started the night before last, and we started losing heat out of the house. And I thought, well, that's just because it was so cold. And then through the day, it never did recover. And so it was 61 degrees in the house when I woke up this morning, which is cooler than we normally have it. And I finally had concluded that, in fact, there was something wrong with our ground source. And so called up this morning. Surprisingly enough, they sent someone right out this afternoon. And I talked to my wife, and it's fixed, so we're good to go. But it's been interesting. There's been a lot of interesting challenges. There was a batch that didn't process correctly last night, and so I spent the good part of the day cleaning up that. And so there's just been a lot of things, but when you're faced with a lot of those things, you just get calm and get quiet and say what comes first, and you just start picking stuff off, and you start putting things away, you know, putting things down, figuring out what you can do to close the loops. Sorry, excuse me. One of the fun things that I've started doing is... now that I'm kind of through the design phase of the vein work stand, now I'm sort of in the play phase of it with the actual stand itself. And so on Sunday, I was trying to learn how to do a kettlebell swing, and I need to get back with that. So kettlebell is a weight, and there's a specific exercise you do with it. And I'd read all the descriptions, and I thought, wait a minute, I have the vein work stand. So I went and grabbed my phone and, you know, flipped it over sideways and recorded myself doing that. I just put it on the floor and recorded myself doing it. And ta-da, you know, that worked out real well. And then I got to thinking at the end of that day, you know, it'd be kind of cool if I would just take some time and take 5 minutes in the morning just to say good morning to my granddaughter. And so I've started this little thing called Good Morning, Clara. And every morning I take about 5 minutes and say, good morning, Clara. This is happening, and this is happening today, and this is what's happening in your life, and this is what's happening in mine, and ta-da. So I was talking to Clara, who, of course, cannot hear this yet because she's only 7 months old, about the fact that sometimes in life there's just a bunch of stuff that's coming at you all at the same time, and you just take it one step at a time, and you just put things to rest. And things are clearing at this point. I still have a lot to do on the VeinWorks stand website. There's just, you know, there is a lot to do. But all of it's going to get done, and it will all be just fine. I think I had mentioned last week, which no one has had a chance to hear yet because I didn't actually upload it. Sorry, I don't think I have a cold, but there's some kind of little sinus drainage thing going around, and it doesn't feel like it's getting any worse. It's just kind of tickled on me for several days here, and I don't know what's happening there. So, anyways, I had mentioned last week about a TED talk that I had heard. TED is a conference that's held all over the world where they invite in speakers who are doing interesting and innovative things and have them give a 20-minute talk about their field of expertise. And then they record them, and then several months after the conference, they're put up, and you can just watch them for free. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting. One of the speakers that they had at some point in the past, this is the first time I had heard her speak, was named Lori Santos. And she is at a prestigious college. I think it's Yale. I can't remember. Doing research in human behavior and doing research into the human condition. And she opened her talk with a couple of observations that she had made about humanity. That humanity, when you look at humanity as a whole, is really smart, is uniquely smart on this planet. She said, when you look at all the things that we do, all the things that we're capable of, what we're in fact doing right now, we are uniquely smart. There's no one on this planet like us. And she said, and we like to tell ourselves that we're smart too. She said, we're a vain species. But in addition to that, the second observation is that we can be really dumb. And this is about the point that my ears perked up, because I thought, okay, let's see how she resolves this. Because the framework explains that. But I wanted to hear what her explanation of this was. And so she went on to describe how that even though we're really smart, we can do things that really lead to bad situations. And she was talking about the financial crisis, how really smart people did things that were really very foolish to do. And she said there's really two possible explanations in her mind for this. I actually have a third, and I'm sure there are others who have others' explanations, but her two possible explanations were that either humans make a mistake because the systems that they design are incredibly complex, and we actually design systems that are more complex than we are capable of operating efficiently, and so we end up making silly mistakes in them. Or the other explanation would be that there is some fundamental problem in our brain that leads us to make these mistakes. She said, because one of the things that we are learning is that human beings will reliably make the same kinds of silly mistakes over and over. And a lot of that stuff is pointed out in books like Predictably Irrational, which is a fascinating book. She said, we wanted to test this to determine if in fact it was the systems that were the problem or it was the human brain that was the problem. And I'm listening going, yeah, okay, let's see what you come up with. This should be interesting. So what they decided to do was start with monkeys, because in her words, monkeys are close evolutionary cousin to us. I think it was a brown capuchin monkey, very intelligent little creature, but they don't have systems like ours. So if they could design some systems, simple systems, teach them to the monkey, then maybe they could determine if the monkey would make the same type of mistake. So they wanted to start with a financial system, but of course monkeys don't use money. So they had to come up with a way to teach monkeys something about valuations and currencies and those kind of things. And what they did is they ended up giving monkeys tokens, just little round metal discs. They would just give the monkey the token and the monkey would look at it and go, yeah. And then what they would do is they had a big open area where the monkeys would live and play, and then they would go into this smaller area, and that became the store. And inside this smaller area, there was a plexiglass shield. In the shield, there were holes. And people working with the experiment would stand there with their hands out with a piece of fruit in their hand. And if the monkey would put the token in their hand, they would get the piece of fruit. And she said very quickly, the monkeys caught on to the fact that they could exchange these tokens for fruit. Very, very quickly, the monkeys also engaged in many of the behaviors that humans do when it comes to money. She said there was larceny. Monkeys were stealing each other's tokens. The monkeys never saved, never kept any tokens back for the next day. They would just spend all their tokens, get all the fruit, eat it all, and then they wouldn't have any more tokens. But she said they wanted to find out if monkeys made the same kinds of mistakes that humans make, that because we're so smart, you would think we wouldn't make them. And the example she gave, I thought was a pretty interesting example. The example is this. First of all, imagine that I have given you $1,000. I've given you $1,000. It's yours. You can spend it on anything you want. Think a moment about how you might spend that $1,000. Now that you know that that $1,000 is yours, I then come back to you and say, now, here's the potential for you to make some more money. You have two choices. The first choice is that I can flip a coin, and if it comes up heads, you get another $1,000. Or if it comes up tails, you don't get anything. That's the first choice. So you can gamble to get another $1,000. Or I can just give you another $500. And she said most people, when faced with that choice, will say, you know, the $1,500 probably is the better choice here because there's no risk involved. Therefore, why not just take the extra $500 and say, okay, thanks. She said humans seem to do pretty well in that situation. She said, now here's another situation. I will give you $2,000. You can think about all the things that you would buy with that $2,000. I have given you that money. It's your money. And now I'm going to come back and say, but you have a choice. You can either allow me to flip a coin, and if it comes up heads, I'm going to take away $1,000. If it comes up tails, you can keep all $2,000. Or you can just give me $500 right now. She said the second problem is the type of problem that humans typically are bad at. Because more humans will pick the fact that they would rather gamble at the potential of taking a larger loss if it means they don't have to lose anything than simply end up with $1,500. And yet the end result of both scenarios is the same. If you just took the $500 in the first scenario, you would have $1,500. If you just gave away the $500 in the second scenario, you would have $1,500. And yet, humans don't do really well with the second scenario. So they actually reproduced this kind of scenario with grapes and with tokens, to where they would have the people who were working with it. They would have one guy who would have three grapes. And whenever the monkey gave him a token, he would only give the monkey two grapes. And then they would have another guy who would have three grapes. And whenever the monkey would give him a token, sometimes he would give them one, and sometimes he would give them three. And they said, in fact, the monkeys gravitated towards the guy who would always give him two, because that was kind of like a sure thing. And then they did it in reverse, where there were three grapes there all the time, but sometimes the monkey would get three, sometimes they'd get none. Wait, this isn't quite right. Anyways, they figured it out. They figured it all out, and in fact, the monkeys made... I'm driving into home, so I gotta wrap this up. And in fact, the monkeys made exactly the same type of mistake that humans make. That that humans and monkeys are loss-averse. We are not necessarily risk-averse. We are loss-averse. We don't like to lose what's already ours. There's something inside us that riles up. I'm getting my mail. One moment. There's something inside us that riles up at the thought of loss, that doesn't rile up if we haven't really, if what we are gaining is not something we really possess yet. And her conclusion was that, in fact, unfortunately, these irrational behaviors that we have, in her mind, were the result of 35 million years of evolution, and that we probably weren't going to untrain ourselves, but maybe if we would make ourselves aware of it, maybe we could slow ourselves down a bit. And I didn't necessarily agree with her conclusion about the 35 million years of evolution. I do agree with the conclusion that if you make yourself aware of it, that you can slow yourself down a bit. I'm backing into my garage. But I think there's another explanation for what might be going on. Because if it's true that we are loss averse, what we're really saying is that we are afraid of losing things. We hate it when we lose things. And to me, that's a flesh response. So now, then, why would the flesh response be stronger for what is, in essence, fear of loss over greed of gaining more? Because in the first scenario, what you really have is you have a situation where if people are really greedy, then they would go for the thousand. They just, and some, that's a gambler's mindset. Oh yeah, just go for the thousand, man. Because think of how much I'd go for the thousand. But most people don't quite have that gambler's mindset. They just go for what's safe. And yet, most people apparently will increase their risk level to keep from losing something. So the question that I have in all of those situations is, why would the flesh push us towards more risk to keep from losing as opposed to pushing us harder towards more greed? And I would submit to you that you might be able to explain this by the amount of destruction that the flesh can bring in the various situations. Let's say that you do the first situation and you look at it and you say, I think I'll do the safer option. So what does the flesh have to tell you at that point? Well, that was really stupid to do the safer option. You could have got $1,000. You could have got $1,000 if you just flipped. And the response that you can have immediately is, well, but I got 500. 500 is better than 1,000 and better than nothing. And I got 500 and I have 1,500. So I'm good. On the flip side, though, the flesh can get a lot of traction if you lose $1,000 that's already yours. It can't get as much traction if you didn't have the 1,000 to begin with. But if you already have the 2,000 and you're saying, oh, that's yours, it can say, oh, think of everything you buy. It can really get you amped up. And if you lose that 1,000 out of the second side, then it can start into, well, that's really stupid. What's wrong with you? I can't believe you lost 1,000. That was stupid. I mean, it can really pound you. And so since it can really pound you in the second scenario, if you take the riskier option, it will amp up your fear of loss so that it can get you to take the riskier option so that it can get much more traction if you lose. You might need to think about that a little bit, and I might need to think about that a little bit. The other possibility would be that fear is actually stronger than greed. And so your flesh is able to push you farther with fear than is able to push you with greed normally. But whatever the explanation is for why one scenario is different than the other, at the core, when this researcher, Laurie Santos, talks about how smart humans are, and then how dumb we are too, it just comes back for me to the fact that we are really competing with ourselves. And we have one part of us that's very smart and creative and innovative and is trying to create this environment of success for us. And then we have another part that's just trying to sabotage us. And so, no, I don't think it's the result of 35 million years of evolution. I just think it's the result of the fact that we have a flesh and we have a spirit. And it really is possible, once you are aware of the fact that you have flesh and spirit, to recognize the tactics of this flesh and then to navigate around them because of that. So, when faced with the situation of having $2,000 and having to get $500 back, or gambling on the fact that I would lose $1,000 of it, I'd like to think that I'd look at it and go, yeah, I think I'll just give you back the $500 and we'll just move on, because it wasn't really my money to begin with. Because I would hope that I would recognize that voice in me and go, no, that's my money. I'm not giving it back. That's my money. I would recognize that voice is flesh. And so I wouldn't convince me to take an even greater risk on something just because I might lose what I already perceive as mine. The direct application for this, for instance, with the VeinWork stand, would be for a product designer such as myself. I build this product, invest all this money in it, and then I get it out, and there's some things about the product that could be better. There's always things about the product that could be better. So what is my response at that point? Do I just say, oh, well, that one was very good. I'm just going to throw all those away, and then I'm going to start again. When in fact, the sales may have nothing to do with the fact as to whether it's a good or bad product. The sales may have to do with the fact that I haven't figured out how to market yet. But if I'm willing just to abandon that first one and then run off and make something else, I'll never learn to market and none of my stuff will sell. But if I recognize that, oh, that's not going to work. If I recognize that's the voice of the flesh, then I can say, well, hold it. I don't really know whether that's going to work or not. Maybe we'll just try this a little bit, but you're going to fail at the marketing. Well, I don't know. We'll just give it a try and we'll just go a step at a time and see what happens. And I'm going to learn a lot of stuff. And if in the end the product doesn't sell, the product doesn't sell. But I'm not going to keep sinking money, you know, getting riskier and riskier in my investments simply because I have to gain back what I've already invested. In my life, I'm willing to treat those things as sunk costs and say, that was interesting, moving on. Because being loss averse really is a tactic of the flesh. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.